My name's Dennis Emery, and I'm going to be interviewing the greatest male player the state of Kentucky has ever produced, Mel Purcell. Mel, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks, Dennis. Appreciate you having me on.
Well, as we jump into it here, you grew up in Murray, Kentucky. How much did it, and again, I'm going to come back to your dad because he's such a legendary figure and a member of this same, you know, Kentucky Tennis Hall of Fame, as well as the Southern Hall of Fame in tennis. But how much did your dad work with you?
He worked with us every day. I mean, he really, you know, we got the right grip. When I was 10 years old, I went to Nashville and worked under Bill Loeffler, was an old pro from Sweden. You know, and he was in his 70s then and worked with him. He told my dad, you don't let anybody touch his forehand. You leave, anybody tries to touch his forehand, you leave it alone. So I think I learned that as a coach. When you see somebody with pretty good talent, you leave their shots alone. You don't try to, you know, read a book or see what the new USTA forehand thing is and everything and try to change it. Right. You know, you know that as a coach, you go with that good shot and then hopefully his strategy will pick up someday. But,
right. How much were you, did your dad work with you and Dell together?
That always was a little combustion right there was involved. But because he was 4 years older, but you know he had practice. I guess in '71s when he took over the full time as tennis coach. But you know Dell was 4 years older. He went 4 years to Murray State. But I'd say you know 2 or 3 hours a day, as far as us working and training and playing, because I played everybody. You know I'd walk up and ask anybody to play when I was 8 or 10 years old, and but basically he spent almost every day with us. I mean he knew what it took, you know, to get to a certain level. And that's what he wanted, you know, us to have an opportunity to get there.
Right. Now, Dell ended up playing number one for your dad at Murray as a senior.
Yes. Yes.
And, you know, we'll go into the high school stuff in a few minutes. So you obviously feel like you got your athletic ability from your dad.
Exactly. 100%. And just with the fact that he traveled, you know, to 50 countries and played with the Globetrotters and the Washington Generals, I think he wanted that opportunity for his kids to, you know, be able to go into something that maybe could travel around and play stuff. So I think he saw that and he tried to give us the best opportunity that we could. And, you know, and it was, like I said, I had my built-in kind of academy. I mean, you came in after school and really, you know, before the rules changed, I mean, I'd play the number 7 guy or 8 guy on the team coming in. Right. You know, I'm 15 or 16 and I'm playing like the 8 or 9 guys. Sometimes if some teams bring a lot of guys, I got to play. So then, you know, I got to play against some college kids when I was 14 and 15. Right. So,
yeah. Now, your dad, you know, had an amazing career at Murray as a coach and recruited a lot of great players, a lot of the Swedish, Norwegians, and that, you know, a lot of the Scandinavian guys. Mm-hmm. How much did you practice with those guys?
All the time. When I came in as a professional, right, you know, it'd be like, you know, George Foreman fighting 5 fighters. One time he did 5 fighters, 3 right. rounds. Yeah, everybody would come in and play me 4 games or whatever. You know, I'd be on court 1, and everybody from 1 through 7, you know, would come in and play. And so that, you know, that helped me too. I mean, you know, I wanted to work out a little bit when I was home, taking a little time off and, but playing, you know, but then in high school, you know, I still got to play, you know, I got my butt beat a lot by some of those good guys. They had some good players.
Yes. I know they did. And, kind of moving on with your dad a little bit. I saw firsthand when I was coaching at Austin Peay, how competitive your dad was, you know, just as a person, as a coach, I never got to see him play. I heard, you know, how competitive he was as a player. How big of an impact did he have on your competitive attitude?
100%. I mean, you saw, you know, I saw him play my good friend Raymond Sims, who's a good buddy of mine here. He played high school basketball at Murray High, was a good player. And my dad, I'd say my dad's 46 right? We're at 16. Yeah, and they played a one-on-one game, right? To 12 for lunch. And I think Raymond still hadn't paid his lunch yet. But I remember him shooting a shot, and it was an easy shot, and Raymond was going to get the rebound. And my dad came in and kind of threw an arm, like a forearm, you know, knocked Raymond down, got the rebound, put it back up. And so, I mean, that's, you know, that's 46. And then he was like that in tennis. I mean, he developed a really good strategy game, and he played all the time. And yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be here without him. I mean, I you know, like I said, when he passed away, probably 60% of me went with him. You know, I still never been the same. So that's just kind of how much of an influence he had.
Well, he so well respected by so many people, you know, and I know I've told you this before, but several years after I was been coaching here and had some success, Cliff Hagan told me one time, he said, you know, why I gave you the job. He goes, I know I interviewed you three times and, you know, I couldn't make up my mind. And so I called my good friend, Benny Purcell from, you know, from our basketball day together. Mm-hmm. And Benny told me to hire you. And that was why, you know, I ended up making the decision to hire you. But it just seemed like your dad impacted a lot of people. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about regarding your father?
Well, but back on what you're talking about, your situation, you know, it was kind of funny because, you know, he told him, like, golly, you know, he wins at Austin Peay. If you give him the money, the budget there, he goes, you'll do nothing but success. And I think, you know, and you're such a good coach, Dennis, he wanted you out of the conference. I mean, that's probably some great teams there. I mean, you know how competitive he was. It'd be like, man, I mean, this is no, but he knew you'd do a good job. And like I said, he and Cliff go way back in the basketball days. And yeah. No, but back to my dad, to be, he, you know, like I was telling, like he was the first Ja Morant, as they say, because I've got these articles when he played up in New York and all these New York sports writers saying, you know, Benny Purcell's probably one of the best guards in the country. Right. And, you know, it's a different game now, 70 years later. But, you know, for him to travel the world and just to be the stud All-American and to love Murray State the way he came back and everything. And it's, yeah. And he was a hard act to follow. I mean, it'd be like, you know, for me to accept the job, I was thinking, God, what am I doing here? But right. Then, and then, you know, I won my first one. I was so excited. And everybody was, yeah, your dad won 10 in a row. What are you all excited about? So it was, you know, I kind of was put in perspective real quick, but, you know, enjoyed, you know, being part of Murray State. And, you know, my dad loved Murray State. He was the quintessential Mr. Murray State. And that's it. I honor his life every day. And I wake up every day, like he said, I feel like I'm on a full scholarship every day I wake up. You know, because you feel good, you know, you got to do what you have to do, but you're on a full scholarship. You don't have to worry about anything. So so he gave us a great attitude. I think that's what I picked up from him. You know, you pick up that competitiveness from him, but he loved life. You know, he liked making people feel good, right? If you walked by, whether he told you a joke, a story, and he had some stories, boy.
I bet. Well, let's talk about your junior career.
And okay.
One of the highlights, you know, especially for the people here in Kentucky, was the fact that you won two state high school doubles with your brother, Dell. And what years did you do that? Were you in grade 7 and 8 when you did that?
Yeah, correct. That would have been 71, 72, I think. Right, or 72, yeah, 71, 72. That, you know, Dell was a great player. Dell had great strokes. You know, he's the one, I mean, I'm the one that's kind of had unorthodox. Dell had perfect strokes. And we just played, you know, we were the first team from outside Louisville, I think, in 20 years to win it. And that's how dominant, you know, the east of the river was down there. So, and we just had some good luck, man. I mean, I was quick and Dell had a little bit of power. And we just had a good time. We were wearing Murray State shirts when we were playing. When we won one of them, it was kind of funny. So recruiting rules were a little different back then, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Any funny stories of anybody you played in those tournaments? Because you know, you would have been so small at that age.
Well, I played as a fifth grader, right? I came my first singles. I came up there, and then I lost the next year. At sixth grade, I played again. I played Ross Bowling. Ross Bowling was going to Murray State the next semester. And they kind of said, you know, tough as coach decision. Who do you spread for? You know, and they just overpowered me. You know, he beat me 5-2. I just couldn't, you know, you hit some good shots. It's just like a bully coming up and just beating you up. A guy that's like 6'8". I mean, you know, just eventually you're going to hit some couple of good shots here and there. I scared him a couple times, but that was fun. And then, you know, the next couple of years, you know, my great friend Mark Beekler just out toughed me. He and I were great buddies, right? And it was like he'd beat me that one year, then I'd kick his butt the next week at the Joe Creason.
Yeah.
And he'd go like, so what? I'm the high school state champion. We're all going to Mobile, you know, like into the Southern Close, right? So I tell you, I took that attitude from Mark, you know, really up into my pro career on, God, why do you get so pumped up over, even though it was a state high school title? You know, I was the one that was so fired up to win one. He's just walking, you know, he always had a laid back walk and just took things in stride. So I think I took a lot of his laid back attitude into my thing. And I haven't talked to him in 40 years, but he'd be like, still be one of my best buddies. That's how we were, even though we competed head to head all the time.
Well, so he played at St. X, and then he went to Clemson and played for Chuck Creasy. He was really one of Chuck Creasy's first big recruits. I remember Chuck telling me how excited he was to get Mark Beekler. But Mark Beekler didn't come across to me as being a great athlete.
You know? He just outsmarted you. You know, he played a little bit like you play. He could go against you. I mean, he'd kind of hit soft to my forehand. You know, it would just take pace off my shot, and he just figured out a way to beat me. I mean, and like I said, I was all pumped up, and he was just had that laid back attitude. I mean, in tennis, you have to have that. You can't get too fired up. You'll get tired. You know, you'll burn up your energy. And
where was the state high school played then? Was that at
was at Louisville. Yeah, that was at the tennis club on Hare Lane. And in Lexington. The other one was in Lexington. So,
I didn't realize that.
And then I finally won one in, you know, my senior year. I beat Mark Alvarez in the finals. But, you know, that was, you know, it felt good. But, you know, really, it'd been nice to have five of them instead of three, I guess. But, you know, when you look back, it really, that's why I try to tell some of these high school kids, you know, work hard. But, you know, when you look back on it, you know, that's all you can do. So.
Right. Well.
One other thing, I guess it was just funny because I'd gone to high school to California that year, right? I went out for like 7 months to train out in California, but I didn't play on a high school their season was in the fall. And man, these people were trying to get me to play, and I wouldn't play because I wanted to come back and play, you know, Murray High for the spring season. So, right. And they changed my backhand, a guy named Paul Cohen, who my dad was trying to change my grip for 6 years, and I wouldn't listen to him. And I would rather run around my backhand and do stuff. But a guy named Paul Cohen, who was a good coach, he coached McEnroe at one time, and he's been he changed my grip. He put a shoestring on my wrist and made me have a backhand grip. And I just dropped and hit balls for like a couple of months. I wasn't able to do anything but just flick balls with a backhand grip. Right. So,
yes.
So that helped my game big time because now I could place the ball more. Before, I was real defensive with my backhand. And now I was like, man, it's almost like putting glasses on. You could see like, wow, you know, that, you know, I could actually, you know, place the ball somewhere instead of just trying to get it back.
I actually have in my notes, you know, you went to California for the first part of your senior year, as you just alluded to. And I didn't realize you worked with Paul Cohen. What led to you going out there? Was that something your dad set up for you?
Yeah, that summer before, right? We'd gone out there. Paul had like six guys come out, a guy named Robert Rosello, Sam Fertopoulos,
right?
Shane Langston, Mississippi, and Mel Purcell from Murray, Kentucky. We worked under him and played a couple of tournaments out there. And then we arranged to come back out and then, you know, for me to go to high school out there and work under him. And that was the difference of my game because, you know, we didn't have indoor courts yet at Murray. So that was just a big decision. Now, I love Paul Cohen to death, man. He changed my game. But I saw his forehand. He had I don't even want to say the silliest forehand. I just told him, I said, you can change my backhand, but don't you ever say anything about your forehand about my, because his hands would go up. If you could look at it, you'd put your right hand up first and come back. And, you know, I just, you know, I already had a good forehand. I remember Bill Loeffler saying that from when I was 8 years old, right? Leave his forehand alone. So, but that was funny. But he changed my game completely because I became, you know, I could hit over the ball and place the ball a little more than I could before. So,
yes.
Yeah.
Any other highlights of your junior career you'd like to touch on?
Well, you know, I got to the semifinals of Kalamazoo that year. You know, I finished third in the country, and I'd already signed with Memphis State. I looked at Texas. Texas, you know, because we had Kevin Kern and Steve Denton on that team. Right. So, you know, that would have put me at number three. So, I mean, I was looking at a national title and everything in a way. But, you know, I was just a Southern boy. I knew Tommy Buford at Memphis State. You know, they offered me a full scholarship and, you know, you could train there at the racquet club. You know, we had indoor courts. So that was a real big decision of mine to go there. I knew I could play one and everything. And then, but I finished that Kalamazoo late. I think if I hadn't assigned, I probably could have signed somewhere else at the end of the summer. Right. But I went ahead and signed early.
Right.
But the junior, I had a good time. I finished third when I was 12 years old in the country and then finished third in the 18s. And then in between there, I just was messing around, I guess. I mean, I could, because well, when I see other guys, I mean, I go, there's no way I could that, you know, but then some guys just, they had your number, you know, some guy, what were you with that guy? I was 1-4. I could never beat that guy. You know, like a guy named Chuck Hodgen was a good player that, I mean, Chuck and I had some battles, man. I think our record's probably 500 or something. And, there's just some guys that, you know, you don't want to play anymore. But the juniors were fun. And, you know, then I loved playing college. I mean, I loved playing high school tennis in a way, you know, back when we were in high school, you know, we had to play every match. You know, now they use this USTA system. You only have to play. You don't even have to play high school.
Right.
I mean, I was third in the country and still going up and playing Mayfield High, you know, Paducah Tillman or something like that. So I don't like that idea of high school. If you're going to play high school, at least play 4 or 5 matches, you know, or this and that instead of. So they've changed that whole attitude of the ranking part. I think that's what, I mean, I've been out of it too long, so. It probably makes sense to some people, but for somebody that plays, like, man, you know, that's why you play high school tennis, to play a match. And then just because you're ranked 7th in the South, you know, you still should play this guy over here at Oldham County. Right. So, I'm kind of an old purist too. So, but
now when you went to Memphis, Tommy Buford was the tournament director for the U.S. Indoor Open.
Yes, he was.
Were you able to get a wild card into that through him?
Yes, I was. And I got a wild card in the qualifying there first. And I played, funny story. It's Friday night, the night before the qualifying. I'm at the racquet club. Tom Gullickson walks in. And he, hey, Mel Purcell, how you doing? You want to hit some? So we hit some. We played. He goes, hey, do you want to play a set? And we started playing 3 or 4 games. And I'm up 4-1. Right. You know, he's hitting my forehand. I'm ripping shots. And man, I'm like, you know, I can play on this tour, man. You know, I'm a freshman in college. So the next morning we come up there. There's the draw sheet. You know, we didn't know before we play each other. OK, so I didn't hit one forehand in that match, man. He kicked it. He kicked every ball to my backhand. He beat me like 2-2. And I asked him, I said, hey, you know, yesterday, man, I was playing. I was kicking your butt, man. What's going on? He goes, man, you'll just learn. You know, when you play with somebody, you hit to their best shot to get some workout. He goes, I was just trying to get a good workout with you. You know, and he was kind of messing with me, too. I always got along with both Tom and Tim. And you know what they did one year in L.A., right? They were playing the Stasi. And I can't remember who it was, Tim or Tom. And then they went behind the curtain. It was Tom playing. they went behind the curtain. Then Tim came out and started hitting right-handed with Nastasi. Right. Yeah, Nastasi goes crazy. Like, what's going on? He's yelling and screaming. And then both of them come out and, you know, looking at him. And it was that was funny, some stories. But they were always pretty good to me. I think my rookie year, when I came out on the tour, everybody was pretty nice to me on that because I'd met some of them when I was at Memphis State. So, but that was always a good thing, you know, to watch that pro tournament and just to see, like, I think I can play with these guys. So it really, that you know, Tommy helped me a lot. He worked with us and gave us the opportunity. And, you know, he knew a lot about tennis. He was a good guy.
Now, after your freshman year, you decided to transfer to Tennessee. And you played for John Newman there at Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
And how many years did you go to Tennessee? 2?
Yeah, 2 years. I had to sit out a year because that was back when, you know, not like now, not like the transfer portal.
Right.
Where everybody could go anywhere. Yeah, even in spring sports. So I had to come back and sit out a year. And, you know, that helped me too because I was able to play some tournaments. You know, I didn't have to go with the team. So I played a couple of men's tournaments in Birmingham, you know, just to try to get some competition. And, but I, you know, Tennessee was great. They gave me an opportunity. They didn't care about tennis. Tennis was about 9 on the importance list there on the athletics. So they kind of let us, you know, work hard and, you know, I trained every day and I knew I'd get my chance to at least try to win an NCAA. And I like Coach Newman was good, man. I played him like 5 sets a day. I mean, he had Prince rackets, right? That's when Rodney Harmon was there and Bill Shelton from Prince would send, you know, Rodney 20 rackets, you know, and everything. And so the coach would be using these big old rackets. But I mean, that just made me competitive. I mean, he wasn't a bad player. You know, I gave him probably about a 75-0 thumping, 75 sets to 0, but but you know, but at least, you know, it was just fun. I liked Tennessee. I mean, we had, you know, the guy Kevin Nash, the guy that was the big wrestler, Big Daddy Diesel. You know, he played basketball there then, and now he's made $20 million, you know, wrestling and stuff. So we had some characters there, and it was, you know, like I said, it was fun. You know, and like I said, Kentucky at that time, it was Grady Johnson. Grady, he didn't show any interest towards me. And so, you know, probably if you were there, I would have considered Kentucky, just to let you know that.
So, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, no. Well, no. Well, because, you know, the thing is, because I knew on my case, I wanted to go to a school to play one and just get that competition because, you know, I didn't win every match. I got beat, but, you know, there was a good number one player at every school in America, really.
Right.
And you know that, Ken. It really, tennis hadn't reached that point, you know, from that SEC football money and all that stuff. You know, not every program in the SEC was strong. You know, my dad dominated those teams up to 85. So
yes,
that,
he did.
Yeah. So you just didn't have that money. And then that once y'all got the money to recruit and do that, then that you just can't compete with that. But
well, you won an NCAA championship in doubles.
Yeah, Rodney Harmon, great partner.
Yeah.
Yes. He hits big serves. He hits big overheads. He poaches a lot. Yeah. What more can you ask about a guy?
Well, I mean, it would almost be, you know, two very contrasting styles you all playing together, you know, with your quickness and his size and all that. Any memories from the NCAA doubles championship?
Sure. I can. I know that I woke up one morning and got beat 0-4 by Marcel Freeman, and I only had 2 losses that whole year. Marcel Freeman in San Diego. Marcel Freeman first round NCAA.
Really?
So I'm like, I'm a little bummed out. I was seated 4th. You know, I thought I had a chance. Okay, now Rodney wins a couple of matches. He's in the quarterfinals against Ernie Fernandez. He's up a set and 5-3 and 8 match points, and he ends up losing that match.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay, so and I have to console him after the match. We have to play a doubles match. I think we play Steve Meister and John Lowe, maybe, if I've got my memory. I have a better memory. I couldn't tell you what I did 3 days ago. But I got him all pumped up, and we won the next round. Then we get to the final, Benson and Tony Giamava. We've won the first set and playing we're in the tiebreaker of the second. I'm serving. That's the 9-point breaker. Remember when one guy serves right. two? Yeah, it goes 2-2-2-3. So I've got the last three serves at 3-all. So I serve, and we lose the first point. So it's 3-4, and then I'm kicking the ball back into Tony Giamava, and it's weird. Rodney poached twice, right? And I found out in the long run that Newman sent the signal in, right? Like there for me, I just kicked. I was so tight, you couldn't have. I mean, I could barely hit it. I had a little Bo Peep serve anyway, and I'm kicking this serve in, and Rodney just poached twice and just slammed the ball up in the crowd, and there we are, man, NCAA champions.
So, oh gosh,
yeah, and it was just, you know, but like I said, Rodney returned well, and with that Prince racket, he was just automatic, and he could have possibly won the singles really that year. I mean, right. Van Hoff ended up winning, beat Rennert in the finals, I think that year,
and that was in Athens, right?
Yeah, always in Athens when we played. And then, you know, great time. And the Georgia fans supported us. You know, they always support a fellow SEC fan. Now, that was different when I was playing Georgia, like, earlier in the year, but that's all right.
Yeah.
But,
Well, at the end of the championship, you decided you were going to turn pro. What led you to that decision?
Well, I'd had enough. I think my time was up in college tennis, and I didn't turn pro until, you know, we were on a junior Davis Cup, like a college Davis Cup team, right? So I was going to play on that. So I really had planned, you know, I really had not planned to turn pro yet. So then the first tournament of the year was Boston, the Longwood Cricket Club, and I lost to Elliot Telcher first round. And I remember walking up to the thing, I was getting up, walking up, you know, and I just told him, yeah, I'm picking up my check here. And she goes, well, you signed as an amateur. I said, no, that's incorrect. I'm professional. and I took like the $1,800 check. I don't know. It wasn't much back then. And there it is. I turned pro, and I still had, you know, I had a wild card in the next couple of tournaments, and still got those because I'd signed with Donald Dell, right? And they ran those tournaments. So I had a wild card, and I ended up beating Eddie Dibbs the next week. So that's when all of a sudden I believed, God, you know, this guy's ranked 18th in the world. I can beat, you know, you believed you could play out here with the guys after that. And then I ended up, you know, getting to the finals of getting to the finals of Indianapolis then at the end of the year. So
you get the wild card in DC
mm-hmm.
based on no ranking at all. Probably, you know.
They'd given some spots to some juniors that year, whatever. Uh-huh. And the right. Davis, and I had that, but since I'd turned pro, you know, I wasn't on the Davis Cup team anymore.
Oh,
but the tournament director still, you know, gave Mel Purcell the wild card because I was with Donald Dell. You know, they own the tournament, so
right.
So at the time, yeah, that was kind of a little bit of a, yeah, there was a few unhappy people in that. I was probably the only happy person in that situation. But you know, like I said, I beat, I forgot who I beat first round. And then, you know, when you beat Eddie Dibbs and then the next day, Ricardo Icaza beat me like 2-2. So I realized, you know, just cause you beat one person doesn't mean anything. You got to be ready to play the next day too. So I just got overly excited.
Eddie Dibbs was the number one seed in that tournament and just a master of the clay courts back then.
He is tough he's a tough out. He's a small guy, but he could, you know, if he had the equipment they had now, he'd be even tougher. I mean, he played good with just, you know, wooden rackets and stuff like that. He and Harold Solomon, you just have to bring your lunch and your dinner and probably breakfast too, right, when you come play them because they just made you run all day and it was tough to beat them.
Yes. And what was your strategy?
You know, I could run all day too, and I could bunt the ball. I was pretty good at being defensive on guys instead of trying to out hit them. You know, our equipment wasn't like it is today either. So it was tough to, you know, so you'd have to kind of play counter reactive sometimes. And I had a big forehand, so I'd set up and try to go. And you just, you know, you're young, you're out there just running around. Everything's new to you. You're punching your fist up in the air, almost getting a little too excited, probably. So, but that's just part of it when you're young and you're kind of just, you know, in your first competition of pro athletes. So
did you sign with Donald Dell?
Yes, I did at the end. Yeah, I did sign with him. I was with Peter Lawler was assigned to me. So, and they treated me right. They you know, they had a lot of different exhibitions and stuff like that. I mean, it was still up to me to play better and to become a better product. Right. It's up to you to work hard. And they did a good job. I was satisfied with my time with them.
Well, you talked about this for a second, but then you go to Indianapolis and play the U.S. Clay Courts, which were a fixture there in Indianapolis. I'm sure your dad went up to that. I remember one point him telling me, you know, he enjoyed going up to Indianapolis to watch you play. And so I'm sure that it was during that time that he did that.
Yeah. He got to watch a lot, like at Cincinnati, Memphis, and Indianapolis. Like, he got to go up there a lot. Now, the weird thing about Indianapolis is, you know, I'm up in North Conway, New Hampshire, and we're playing a doubles match, like, on a Friday afternoon. And it's Tracy DeLatte and myself. And we're playing Andrew Patterson and Tom Gullickson, I think it is. I think so. Yeah, I think so. It could be Bernie Mitten, but I think it's Gullickson. We had a match point, and if we'd have won that match, you know, we played the semis the next day on Saturday, and I wouldn't have played the qualifying in Indiana. So we've got a match point. And I'm coming in. Andrew Patterson hits a topspin lob, you know, and I'm running for it, thinking it's going out, and hits the back of a line. And it skews off, and I run up and jump up, and I land in this thing on some rope. I burnt the back of my hand, my back of my butt, you know, like in the my leg, and you know. And then we end up losing the match, and you know, we get to Portland, Maine, and get a flight to Indianapolis. You know, I end up qualifying. I went from 180 in the world to 35, you know, like within 8 days or something like that. So I mean, and it's all because Andrew Patterson's topspin lob, you know, that hit the damn back of the line. So, you know, I mean, because otherwise I think I still would have been, you know, productive somewhere, but a lot of times you need that big break. And that's really what really helped me out, something like that. And then, you know, I was in good shape. We'd played a tournament. We played something that summer. We played that down in Rockwell, Texas, like it was 118, right? People just dying on the court. And I played a USTA satellite for 5 weeks. So, I was on the team then. That's why then when we played Boston, then when we turned pro on that one. So, yeah. So it was, you know, it was fun. And I knew I belonged, you know, right after I got to the finals, you know, and I came into New York wearing a Yankee helmet, you know, because I'd already played the U.S. Open twice as a junior. Because I'd won the national 21 and under. That back then they had a 21 and under satellite circuit. And if you won that national U.S. Open wild card, and I won that 2 years in a row. So, right. But coming in with a Yankee home, hey, Mel, you a Yankee fan? Yeah, hey, what's up? and then when I played Shlomo Glickstein the next year, there wasn't one person for me. They were yelling, yeah, nice headband, you son of a bitch, because it was just, you know, and I told them, hey, you know, I won Tel Aviv. Don't give me a hard time. So you know, because that's the way I played. I was more about the show. You know, I always wanted to be number one. I think being the best player that you could be. But, you know, I wanted to have fun and because that's what we were. We're entertainers. So, you know, whether you got booed or cheered, you'd rather be cheered. I mean, it feels better. But I've been booed a few times, too. And that's OK. That's OK also, because they got their. They paid for their ticket, right? The fans are still right. So.
Yeah. So you lose to Clark in the final after beating Solomon. And as you say, you play through the U.S. Open. And at the end of the year, you're named the ATP Rookie of the Year.
Yeah. The ATP and the Tennis Magazine Rookie of the Year. So and then I went up to New York up there to get my Rolex watch. Right. They gave out Rolex watches. Rolex was, in, you know, owned Tennis and Golf Magazine, or they were the main sponsor. And so, yeah. And then right then I just bleed. So, you know, we signed my schedule now. So now you had to play so many tournaments, you know, tennis was a little late on, unlike golf, right? Cause that's instead of Bjorn Borg saying, hey, Bjorn Borg, here's $5 million. Where would you like to play? Cause we'd like to promote the tournaments, you know, cause back then they told you where to play.
Right.
If you were ranked 21, you'd have to play 10 tournaments and then three little ones. But they were telling, you know, Borg, he'd have to go to Tampa or Tel Aviv or Egypt somewhere. He's, you know, I just think they did it wrong, right? Because they, you know, because back then, if you had a guarantee, it was illegal, even though they were giving them out at most tournaments. But they should have just said, you know, Bjorn Borg, here's $3 million. You know, will you play these tournaments, the Grand Slams, and that's it. So I think, you know, tennis, nowadays the money's just huge. I mean, first round to the Opens, what, $90,000, $100,000?
Yeah.
I've got a $1,200 check from my first round thing. And you can, you know, Rod Laver and all them could probably even go back farther on that one. But
yeah,
I'm glad for him, because we didn't have a union really until I got out of tennis, 1990, right? So that's when the money started getting a little, you know, I think when they started promoting a little better than they did. So,
well, so rookie of the year, and then you end up the next year in 81, you win three titles. You win Tampa, Atlanta, and Tel Aviv.
Mm-hmm.
You go up to where you were ranked 21 in the world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Any thoughts on any of those?
Well, the first tournament, your first one, you always remember. Now, my first pro victory was in the Bahamas. I won like the Marlboro Cup they used to have down there at the Ocean Club in Paradise Resort and right. Paradise Island. And I beat Buster Mottram. So that was my first $3,500 check, like pro victory. But the Tampa Bay was fun because it was spring break and I had a bunch of guys from Murray State that I knew down there. One guy was Bud Foster. He was the defensive coach for Virginia Tech football for all those years under Beamer.
Right.
And they called him the Murray Six, right? Like a mafia. The Murray Mafia Six came down and I beat Jeff Broviak in the finals of all. That's, you know, he was a tough act. I mean, he was a good player, you know, from California. I mean, he could play classical piano, man. He was just a smart human being, and I just toughed him out 4 1/3. I mean, I was lucky. And then the other one, the one in Atlanta, I beat Gilles Moritone, but I beat Elliot Telcher in the semis. But I had a bunch of my Tennessee guys there that I went to school with, so I had a rowdy crowd yelling, "Give them hell, Mel." So that kind of upset Telcher and Moritone a little bit. But and then Tel Aviv, you know, I ended up. It was Per Herquist in the finals, who was from Sweden, right? Per was a – so, that, you know, those are the three. And I got to the finals of five other ones I probably should have won. But I enjoyed my time out there. I never looked back. I think, you know, my only regret's not playing the Australian Open. You know, I never traveled down there at the end of the year because it was always in December up until 85 or 86 when I played.
Right. So,
and I'd played all year. I just decided to take a rest. But I that's my only regret, that I didn't go down at least play a couple of Opens. So,
well, let's talk a little bit about the Grand Slams.
Okay.
You played Wimbledon six times, but we want to focus on 83.
Okay.
In 83, you got to the round of 16. Is that right?
No, the quarters. Quarterfinals. Yeah.
Yeah, quarters. So you beat. Is that Tim Wilkinson you beat?
Yeah, second round. And then Brian Godfrey was the match in the round of 16. I think Anders Maurer, too, I might have beaten in that thing. But the funny part was I beat Godfrey. I'm the first guy in the quarters, right? And I beat him. So I go to the locker room. Somebody says, yeah, you need to go to the press room. And so I walk one person in there, right? I mean, I walk in. Not one, but all of them are on court two with Kern and Jimmy Connors. Right? Uh-huh. They're playing, and Kern ends up beating him. And then that night's kind of funny. I talked to my dad, and he goes, well, they put on the thing like the winners of the quarterfinals in Wimbledon. He goes, they left your name out. So it's like it's almost like all this little stuff was happening. But here's the weird thing. So I'm in the quarterfinals of Wimbledon, and I play Chris Lewis. And that's a Monday. I won on a Monday. So you don't play again till Wednesday, right? You always get a day off. So we're at the Hard Rock Cafe having a great time. And Fritz Buehning comes up and goes, hey, man, your third match on tomorrow. I go, no, I'm not. I don't play till Wednesday. So there I am. I'm third match on Tuesday. I'm the only quarterfinal match playing on a Tuesday, which was where nobody was in doubles, right? It wasn't really a schedule issue. So, you know, instead of being really comfortable, you know, I've kind of didn't get a real good night's rest, went out. I won the first set against Lewis, and then he beat me 6-0 second set, and then I lost 6-5. And he played just like me, though. He's quick. You know, like if he would move left, if I move left, he moved left by looking at yourself in the mirror. Right. Yeah, it was like that. Like we were dinking each other, and it was just, you know, he just outquicked me and outdinked me and just played a great match.
Yeah. That's the year he went to the finals, or?
Yeah, he lost to McEnroe in the finals because he beat Kern in five sets in the semis.
Oh,
so, you know, that would have been a tough match. I mean, I'd love to play Kevin, but Kevin was a pain in the butt to play too because he could serve big. And he's just, you know, when I say that, I mean that as complimentary. Like, man, I just know I have to work harder, you know, today, you know, when you know these guys have these big serves and big shots.
Did you like grass?
I loved grass. You had to play on it a little more to get comfortable on it, but you had to have the right pair of shoes. You know, and everything had to be right. But yes, I did. I mean, especially when you're winning a couple of matches, for sure. But that's the key to playing good on it, is accepting that it is different and try to have fun on it instead of fighting the elements. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, you play the U.S. Open in your career a total of 10 times.
Yeah. I guess if you 14 times, if you count juniors and then senior doubles. So, yeah, so it's 14, yeah.
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 Well, in singles, it seems like you played 10 times. You know, as you said, twice as an amateur, and you kind of had described those experiences.
Yeah. But
at the Open
one thing I was going to tell you about the old U.S. Open, and McEnroe he resorts to this a lot. In the old days, you'd have to come from the locker room and then go out to the stadium court, you know, and it almost felt like a boxing thing because I got to play some night matches too. I got to play Gomez one time. I beat him in five sets and had some good wins, but you would run through and it'd be like a boxing thing. All right, give him Mel, go Mel, go get him. Yeah. And then, you know, nowadays, you know, everybody's, you know, you just walk straight out. You don't really get part of that crowd. So I think that was kind of the fun part about being at the Open, man. It was just, you know, people yelling and screaming, and I like noise. I like, you know, I think people should be able to yell and scream when you're playing, man.
Well, it's a little bit of what you're describing is what Jimmy Connors used to describe about playing the Open.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I know you guys are friends. We'll get to that in a minute.
One year I played in the Stasi. You know, I got that one year in 81, and I was in center court the last match of the day, and they let everybody come down and sit in there. And of course, you know, 9,000 of them are all the Stasi fans, you know, even though he's 37, right? And this is my like third year on the tour, I think. And man, they're coming down. Hey, you faggot. Hey, yeah, nice headband. Nice gap in your tooth. I mean, I was. You know, and here's the same fans you thought were cheering you when you had your Yankee helmet on the year before.
And, right.
And no, but it was, you know, I'd have beaten him like three. I mean, it was a tough, but it was, but that's fun. I love that. You know, it wasn't like, oh, these guys, they suck up there, man. It was like, I mean, I thrive on that. And that just makes me play better and try to, you know, be more of a showman, I guess. So.
Well, quite a match, Nastasi. Purcell. I can see that. But another guy that you beat there was Stan Smith.
Yes.
Who's one of the all-time American greats. Anything you remember about that match?
Yeah, I played him and it was just hot. You know, he'd played, and that was just one of the things. I was honored to play him, but I was fired up, you know, to beat a former number one player in the world but you know, it was just one of those things. I was fired up and ready to go. And another year, I beat Sherwood Stewart first or second round. And I remember walking, and somebody yelled, "Hey, Mel, did you beat that old man, Stewart?" Somebody yelled, and Sherwood's walking next to me. And I looked at him, and he looked at me, and I go, yeah, I won the match. Yeah, and Sherwood looked at me. He goes, "You just wait till you're 39. Because he was 39 at the time.
Right.
I think I was 22 or 23 probably. And I could just remember him. You know, he was number one in the world in doubles at that time. He was a great doubles player.
Right.
You know, he was a real competitor, too. But I just remember him saying that, though. Just say, yeah, okay, buddy. Because I was trying not to laugh when a guy said that. And he was right next to me. I go, No, man, I didn't say anything. You just wait, you know. And I can always remember when I turned 39. I can still remember when he said that. But but that was fun because that was back in the old U.S. Open when you played some of those backcourts, right? And you would walk back in and mingle in with everybody. And I always liked that part. Except Wimbledon was a little tighter. There wasn't much room to walk around like there was at the Open. Like, you know, it's kind of like the old Forest Hills was like that, right? It finally outgrew itself. So yeah.
Now, where did you play Stan Smith? Did you play him at Forest Hills or the new stadium?
Yeah, Flushing Meadows. Yeah, I got to play Forest Hills like my first year in the juniors. I lost to Lindell in the third set, 6-4 in the third that one year. I played him. I beat him one year in Costa Rica. I beat him like one night at 7-5 in the third. Then the next morning, I played him again in like the individual, and he beat me like 2-1. He remembers when you beat him or something. He goes, "I remember last time. I'll kick your butt." So yeah, because Lindell and I always got along. I got a couple of wins over him, but he'd always make you remind you that you shouldn't have beaten him. Like the next time you play him, he was always a good player.
We're actually gonna come back to that in a minute. So let's go to the French Open, which you played 6 times. You got to the fourth round in 81 and 82. Any memories of that?
Yeah, I mean, I had chances, you know, but that first year I played Connors. I mean, I was up, he was up 2 sets to love, 4-1, 40 love, right? The match is over. Next thing I know, I'm up 6-5, serving 40-15 to win the third set. We'd already played 3 hours and 30 minutes, right? Hell, it was still in the third set. And I mean, that's unbelievable. And I have an easy volley. I remember I go there and I hit it and it went and landed about a half. And then I ended up losing in the tiebreaker, I think. And yeah, that was a really good chance. And then I lost to Gerolaitis that the next year or one of those. I had a good chance. So I had fun at the French. You know, the court was real slow and chunky. And I liked that because I could move around pretty good. There really wasn't a ball that you felt like you couldn't get to. So I enjoyed, you know, and I had my chances to go farther, but I was proud of what I did when I was there.
Yeah. Quarterfinals of the doubles with Vince Van Patten.
Yes. Vinny and I had a great time. Vinny was more about the show also. So we both collided pretty good together on that. And yeah. he was, but here's the funny part about Vinny. I mean, I love him. He'd get that espressos, right? He'd get the ball kid to go bring him back one of the coffee espressos. And, man, he'd take that. He'd be out fired up. He'd hit 3 or 4 games all fired up. Then you know, like that. He'd send the ball kid back for another espresso. So he was just always, you know, he was just fun, man. He was fun to play with, and he was a good player when he could return the way he did. I mean, it just made it easier as a doubles player. You know, we played a few other times together, a lot of exhibitions. And I mean, he was a top 25 player in the world at one time. I mean, he could play big time tennis at times.
Yeah. So, and the girls over in France had to love that doubles team.
That's all right. I mean, he was more about that anyway. I mean, he always wanted to like choreograph like a match or whatever. And I said, well, I think we can win it. He goes, who cares? Let's have a good time. Let's go. And I said, okay, so I would just say, okay, let's do it. Oh, there. And I remember one time we were playing, we were getting beat like 6-0, 3-0. And then we won a game. Right. And he wanted to like do like a dance, a pirouette and like that. And we did that. Like nobody laughed. Right. So I said, hey man, that might be the last of our duet act. So that, you know, that was just part of the show too, of playing and having fun. Cause I knew it was a privilege to be on the tour, and it was just a good time. I mean, it's still the same way now. I know the money's like, you know, 30 times bigger, and everybody has an entourage now. You know, before you might have your brother come in, have your coach and, you know, somebody else now, but you know, they make enough money where they can, I mean, that's good to see that they have the opportunity. But when we played, you know, it was just more about having a good time and playing hard. And Vinny and I, you know, fun part of that, of being on the tour.
Well, you know, what we're going to do now is we're going to just, it seemed like you were friends with everybody on the tour during that time. And, you know, such a different group of people, but I've got 5 people here I'm going to ask you you know, give me your read on them as a person. Ironically, the first one is Yvonne Lindell, who you beat in Boston in 82.
Yes, and after that match was over, he grabbed me, my hand, and pulled me like right next to his eyes and goes, "I will never lose to you or anybody else because I'm not in shape." And because it was 100, you know, it was 110 degrees on the court, right? And we had a couple long points and I toughed him out. So that was kind of the thing I remember about. And I'd been playing Yvonne since junior. So we'd always, you know, had a little respect for each other, but beating him that time, he thwarted me a few other times after that. But he's always been always good to me. That was always, sometimes they always say, they might see him at a tournament and somebody say, "Hey, you know, we're from Murray. Mel Purcell says hello." He'll go, what is that jerk doing now? What is he doing? You know, that's just kind of how, you know, that's his type of that. That's just his humor and stuff like that. So, yeah, I always got along with Yvonne. He and McEnroe's matches were fun to watch.
Yeah. Okay. Second one is Jimmy Connors. And it seemed like you all were kind of kindred spirits in a lot of ways, you know, I know you played differently, but you both relied on ground strokes, quickness, and you both loved the entertaining aspect of the match.
Yeah, and that's who I kind of, you know, idled my game after. I mean, I saw him play, you know, as a youngster. You know, I met him when I was 11, and he was 18 at St. Louis. And the thing, I think just the fact when I played him on the tour, we had so many tight matches that he invited me to play that Champion Senior Tour, which was fun to play there for a few years. So that, yeah. And he was just a tough, you know, I loved watching him play and loved playing against him. I mean, he was fun to play, but he was just, you know, you had to bring your lunch, dinner, and breakfast again when you're going to play him.
Best returner you ever saw?
Yeah, I think so. You know, Andre would be up there too, for sure. But yeah, but Connors and Andre really at the top two of all time, for sure. The way he could take big serve, even with that OT 2000 racket that he has.
The third one is Bjorn Borg. What was your relationship with him?
The nicest guy in the world, man, right there. I mean, I got along with Bjorn. I played him my first time at 81 at Wimbledon, and we were the only match of the day. It kind of rained a little bit, and our match finished, so they showed that. In there, but no, but Bjorn's just a great guy. He would come, people would come by, "Bjorn Borg, I love you, man," and kiss him on the forehead. And, you know, and he'd just look and say, hello, how are you doing? And, you know, Connors and McEnroe might say something different to him. But yeah, Bjorn was just like that. He was real friendly to everybody and was just a cool guy. I mean, I wish he'd have been in the game longer. Like I said, I wish they would have just promoted the game a little differently back then to keep him in the game longer. So,
well, number four is John McEnroe.
Yeah, I've known Johnny since we were 12. We played junior tennis together. And, you know, you didn't expect that he'd get to his level where he was at that time. Now, we were down at in Texas trying to make a junior Davis Cup team while he's in the semifinals at Wimbledon. Right. So that's kind of when he stepped, you know, away from everybody else. Right. And started like, you know, getting ahead of people. But John and I had gotten along fine. We've had some matches when you play against him, it's a little different. You might get a few yelling and screaming and, "Yeah, thanks for holding up the new balls," or something like that. You know, he like did that to me down in Florida or somewhere. I beat him in the senior thing. And that's what he did after the match was over. Like, "Yeah, thanks for after the match was over. Yeah, thanks for holding up the new balls." Like, what are you talking about? So, yeah, and he's just fiery, right? I mean, he was great for tennis, right? I'm really into, but I've known him, and you know, he's been a good friend, you know, a good friend really for a long time. And I think he does a great job, you know, commentating. I think everybody enjoys his commentating. So.
Right. Well, the last guy was Boris Becker.
Who I met Boris when he was young, like 15, when he played an exhibition in Portland, Oregon. Right. And so I've known him, and then I got a win over him in 86 and in Germany, right? On there. And I beat him like 6 in the third, 7-5 in the third. And he and just one of those things. But every time I saw Boris was always friendly, right? To everybody, right? I mean, that's the thing. He always had a great attitude. You love watching him play because he played a lot like me. I love diving and doing stuff. Cliff Ritchie was my idol. That's who I saw play at the U.S. Open when I was 10 or 12, and he was diving. I said, that's how I'm going to play right there. So, yeah. And Boris, you know, the same way. That's how Boris plays. You there?
A little bigger game than Cliff, but yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But they have the same bruises, I'm sure, on the knees and elbows. So that's and Boris, like I said, I always saw him, and he was always friendly to anybody. You know, whether you were top player in the world or just another player, he seemed like he always treated everybody the same. So,
well, let's go to the end of your career here. I have two more things I kind of want to talk to you about. So you had an elbow injury that basically put you out of the game. Is that correct?
Well, no, it was a car wreck. I hit a deer and everything. No, it didn't hit the ball as hard, I guess. You know, I'm not going to use that as an excuse. I mean, it put me out for a year or two. Then I came back and had that win over Becker and Noah in that 87. So I think what happened, I just lost, you know, my desire to compete, I guess. You know, I'd played for 10 or 12 years, and, you know, once I was losing and it didn't bother me, I was kind of time to, and the money issue wasn't that big. That might have changed my mind if the money was like it was now. So, because that could have changed. But I think just the fact that I wasn't competing and it didn't bother me losing as much. So that's kind of what happened.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Well, then you become the coach at Murray. You succeed your father. Is that?
That is correct. I moved back here to take care of my grandmother. My grandmother had moved back with us, my dad's mother. And anyway, that's the last thing I thought I'd be doing is coaching. You know, I didn't want to follow my dad. That's like following, you know, Adolph Rupp, you know, up there in Kentucky or, you know, something. So it was like, you know, but I just started working with the team a little bit and this and that. One thing led to another. You know, he started letting me to do more with the team. And then once I got on that senior tour, a little bit, right? It was kind of cool, you know, being able to travel as the Murray State coach, and I was promoting the university in Murray State pretty good. I was all in Tokyo, South Africa, you know, different places, but it was cool. You know, it helped recruiting too. I got my best player, that Nikola Aracic, man, but he was the best player to ever play in the OVC conference, I think, ever. And I got him when I was in South Africa, ran into a guy that had stayed at his house in Germany. So, you know, so that's the great thing about being able to travel as a coach. And then I ended up, had a great team right there. My first in the year 2001 and two gave you a little bit of scare.
Yeah,
just a little bit. Yeah. I was just a one or two player short of a good team. That's that you can say that every time, but, it was fun. I had a great time coaching. I mean, you know, it's hard to win one title, and I won a couple, and it's just, you know, everything led to another. But just being able to travel that much really led to being able to be a good coach. And, you know, I love working with the guys. I got a bunch of Brazilian kids, made a good connection with a service down there in Brazil, and they came in and worked hard, did everything you asked of them. And one's a doctor now, graduated at Harvard Medical School. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that feels good. I think you the same way can look back, you know, and glad you helped out these guys. Cause you know, I wanted them to have a good experience. I gave them a tough schedule. We never had an easy schedule. So I told them, well, life will be like that too. When people beat up on you. So, so hopefully that worked out. And, you know, I still hear from most of them. A few of them keep in touch. Some don't, but that's all right too, I guess.
Yeah. So, well, is there anything you would like to get onto this recording that I didn't cover?
No, I mean, that's, you know, I just enjoying, you know, but now I'm back in Murray after the, and, you know, they dropped the men's program in 2016 and it really just that I just give a few lessons here at home and just, you know, really proud of the fact that I played tennis and, you know, I try to give back lessons and try to give clinics around here. And, like I said, I love waking up every day on a full scholarship. You know, I have my dad's attitude, you know, hopefully, and you know, I still play doubles in Paducah. My friend, Larry Heflin, you know, every weekend we play over there with a couple of guys and, you know, I play golf two or three times a week and just, you know, I just enjoy, you know, I like Murray. I enjoy Murray, you know, enjoyed my time. And, you know, and I guess, you know, I could write a book, you know, to get the rest of the stories out, but I think I'm just going to let it be, let it rest.
Well, you know, I personally am hoping you'll write the book. You know, because I would love to read it. You're just an icon in Kentucky tennis. You always represented the state so well and continue to do so. And we're, you know, I think I speak for everybody when I tell you how proud we are to have you be from our state and represent us the way you do.
Well, and I always do that. I'm always proud. You know, always, you know, I was born in Joplin, Missouri. My mom was from there. But, you know, I've always been from Murray, Kentucky my whole life because my dad had so much connections here. But, you know, I love Kentucky. I love the state. You know, I went to school in Tennessee and Memphis State. I've covered about every section but Vanderbilt. They wouldn't let me in Vanderbilt. So I wonder why. But that's, you're right. I've just had a great time, and I do enjoy and love the idea that I'm from Kentucky and enjoy being an ambassador for the sport. Yeah, I really do. So,
well, Mel, thank you for your time, and I'm sure many people are gonna love this podcast. Thank you so much.